So my point is that all of these proposals, that we can only have a consensus for a Palestinian state or to end the occupation by ignoring all of the crucial details and maintaining this vague language of based on the 1967 border. And ask yourselves this: if it were possible to partition Palestine in a way that satisfied a bare majority of Israelis and Palestinians, why wasn't it done in 1993 when the Oslo Peace Accord was signed? It wasn't done because, as the Palestinians and Israelis said, these issues are too difficult. We can't do it. There's no partition we can agree on right now. So we need an interim period of 5 years in which we build confidence and actually build settlements, but they said confidence. In 5 years, everything will be easier. Now, ask yourselves, if it was impossible then to partition the land, is it easier now after Israel has doubled the number of settlers? What was impossible in 1993 is even more so now. And herein lies the problem. The Israelis have succeeded in their stated goal of making an independent Palestinian state impossible. But they have also done something they didn't really intend to do, which is to make a Jewish state impossible. Why? Because Israel, the West Bank and Gaza Strip today effectively function as a single country. But it's a country in which half the population, 5 million Israeli Jews, enjoy a full monopoly on political, military, and economic power, and the other half of the population, 5 million Palestinians, are totally disenfranchised. And you can hide this in three ways. One, by saying the situation is temporary. So the occupation is, under international law, a temporary situation. But now it's gone on 40 years. It's no longer temporary. So the disguise of temporariness, well, we know this situation isn't right, but it's temporary, expires after a few decades. The second argument you can make is that I'm forgetting my points. Whenever I count, I forget what the points are. The second way you can hide it, I remember now, is by having a process, an endless process. So if somebody owes you money and they keep telling you the check is in the post, the check, it'll arrive next week. But it didn't arrive. No, don't worry. I put insufficient postage on it and it came back. I will put postage on it and send it again. The check didn't arrive. Yes, I know, but on the way to the post office, my car broke down and so on. So as long as there's a process, you're off the hook. There doesn't have to be that confrontation with the fundamental injustice of it all. And so this is why there are many, many people interested in a process. The Palestinian Authority, the Israelis, the European Union, the UN, the US, everyone can feel comfortable supporting a process. It costs nothing to support a process. It's very costly to confront injustice and to dismantle systems of racism and apartheid. It's very costly. And nobody wants to do that. Not the Palestinian Authority, not the Arab regimes, not the UN, and we were talking earlier, even the European Union, which supposedly was supposed to take a more even-handed approach, has given up and has thrown up its hands and is not making any effort to stand in the way of the Israeli-American approach. So I think where this leaves us now is with the recognition that this whole system of process without peace, has reached a dead end. And yet, there is really nothing to replace it. There's no conception out there that that is ready to step in. And I think that's where our role is very important. We have to create that alternative. And it's very clear that there's a growing discussion that the most humane solution, the one that allows Israelis and Palestinians to fulfill their needs, is to recognize that there is in fact a single entity, a single country, and to transform this single country into a democracy for all its people. And it can be a democracy which recognizes the special place of Jewish people in Palestine. There's no reason to deny that, but not at the expense of Palestinians. So there's no contradiction between an Israeli family living in Hebron or Ramallah, not as a settler coming by force, but as a neighbor, and no contradiction between a Palestinian returning to her family home in Jaffa or Haifa or Acre. And such a state or a democracy could have many models. There are many models out there of multi-ethnic democracies. Earlier I mentioned Belgium, Canada, all kinds of models which have been used to overcome histories of injustice and genocide and racism and create a system in which everyone's rights and interests can be in balance. The Israeli approach right now is to say that the only way we can is the only way we are willing to conceive of the future is as a Jewish ethnic entity. And the problem there is that Israel no longer has a Jewish majority. That in the United States, African Americans were nationally about 12 or 13% of the population. And yet it was impossible to maintain apartheid, to maintain Jim Crow, even against a numerical minority of 12 or 13%. In Palestine, in Israel, Palestinians are 50%. And so, and every projection says that within a short time, whether it's 3 years or 5 years or even 20 years, it doesn't matter, they will be a majority again as they were prior to 1948. And then really the game is up for Israel. Then the options are very limited. It's to try to continue to maintain this system of absolute rule through brutality, to simply try to suppress the Palestinians, or as some Israelis have proposed, the Moledet Party, which was until last summer in the Israeli cabinet. Let me read to you from their election manifesto. Moledet has successfully raised the idea of transfer. I'm sorry, let me go back a bit. Yeah, Moledet in its election manifesto said Moledet is an ideological party in Israel that embraces the idea of population transfer as an integral part of a comprehensive plan to achieve real peace between the Jews and the Arabs living in the land of Israel. And they say Moledet has successfully raised the idea of transfer in the public discourse and political arena in both Israel and abroad, within the framework, of course, of achieving peace. Moledet is actively involved in establishing these facts on the ground by encouraging the emigration of displaced and hostile elements from our land. So there's a party that went to the voters on a platform of ethnic cleansing, won seats, and was invited into the Israeli government until last summer. There are other proposals in Israel for how to deal with the impending Palestinian majority. Just on the 1st of February, Dr. Yitzhak Kadman, the executive director of the National Council for the Child in Israel, revealed in an article in Haaretz that senior Israeli government leaders had used a cut in child allowances as an attempt to reduce the birth rate among Arabs, among Palestinians. This is among Palestinians who are citizens of Israel. And this follows the usual racist conception, which is found in this country, that poor people have babies so they can collect welfare. And Dr. Yitzhak Kadman revealed that the Israeli senior Israeli leaders told the leaders of the Shas party that the intent was to reduce the Arab birth rate. And in December 03, at a conference in Herzliya, attended by all of Israel's senior political and military establishment, Dr. Itzhak Ravid, who is a senior researcher at the Israeli Government Armaments Development Authority, called for Israel to, quote, implement a stringent policy of family planning in relation to its Muslim population. And he added, speaking of an area in southern Israel which has a high Bedouin population, the delivery rooms in Soroka Hospital in Beersheba have turned into a factory for the production of a backward population. Now, I'm not here to tell you that I think most Israelis believe this. I don't think that. Or there aren't Israelis who will stand up and oppose this. There are. But what's remarkable is how widespread this discourse has become in Israel and how common it is now for Israelis on the left and the right to talk about non-Jews as a demographic time bomb or as a demographic threat. This is the prelude. When you talk about a human population as a demographic threat, it's the prelude to policies of whatever it would take to stop Muslims having babies. And it's astonishing that in Israel, that these things are being said as the rest of the world is marking the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And it should further be pointed out that the 1951 Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, which was created specifically as a response to the atrocities of the Nazis in Europe, states that, quote, imposing measures intended to prevent births within a specific national, ethical, racial, or religious group constitutes a form of genocide punishable under the convention. And so it is entirely accurate to say, legally speaking, that senior Israelis can get up on stage in front of the political and military establishment and propose genocide. I think we have to take this risk seriously, but I don't want to overstate it. But it indicates that really the Israelis are flat out of ideas. I think that's the more significant point, that when you get to the point where you want to prevent births so you can maintain a numerical ethnic majority, really, you have reached the end of the road. When you want to use genocide to preserve your democracy, you have reached the end of the road. Now, here's the paradox. In this, and I want to stop since I've been speaking a long time, we have to start a different discussion. I think a lot of what we see among Israelis is driven by fear that that giving up power is terrifying because you have every reason to be afraid of those you've victimized. And so often those who are the victims of this racism have the unfair burden of reassuring their oppressors while at the same time resisting the oppression, which is really a paradox. But from the perspective of very little knowledge that I have, that is what the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa was able to do, to hold out a vision which in the end white South Africans could see themselves in, and yet at the same time to oppose uncompromisingly the apartheid regime. And I think I want to leave that idea as a proposal for a model to see whether it's something we can take up and adapt for the present circumstances. Thank you for your attention. I'm sorry for speaking so long.
We are very fortunate to have Dennis Brutus, who is a longtime fighter for human rights, a professor emeritus from the University of Pittsburgh, who spent quite a bit of time on Robben's Island with Nelson Mandela, and I want to invite him up to say a few words. I want to make sure everyone stays for a discussion. I'm sure that much of what you heard from Ali Abu Nima might be new. Are in a period of where we, people who live here, need to have this discussion, and we really want to have that discussion tonight as well. So, welcome, Dennis.
Thank you, Kate, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you, and I'm delighted that we've had a distinguished guest speaker here. I'm sure he's raised some very complex ideas and in some cases controversial ideas, but I'm sure he will be willing to respond to your questions and your comments. And I will not take too much of your time, especially since his focus has been very specifically on what is happening in the Middle East today, the whole notion of a moment of opportunity or a window of opportunity, which may well be, in fact, a kind of a cul-de-sac, more of a dead end than a window of opportunity. But I'm sure he'll be willing to develop that. So I thought I would take up two other points. One, he made a passing reference to question of South Africa and apartheid, but I also feel I ought to give you a sense of what is happening internationally as opposed to what is happening nationally in the Middle East in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So let me devote a little time to that first. I came back today from Brazil, where I had been part of the World Social Forum, where the two issues of Palestine and of Iraq and of action in relation to those two were discussed in many. There were 2,000 workshops going on, and I was only able to get to about 20 of them, but I must admit that even 20 was pretty exhausting. So that you will forgive me if I keep my comments brief. But in addition to the discussions there, and there were people from 110 countries coming together in Brazil for the World Social Forum. In addition to that, when I came back today, I found I had a phone call from University of California in Berkeley, where they are discussing the question of divestment from Israel and Israeli industries. So I want to return to that very briefly, and as you know, that's happening at other universities as well. In addition, in London very recently, we had two major events directed to the question of support for the Palestinians. One was at London University, and the other was at Alexandra Palace, which is a huge kind of convention center, where one of the speakers with me was Mustafa Barghouti, whom you mentioned. So there's so much happening in other parts of the world on the question of Israel, on the question of arriving at a solution. But I think it's very important for us here in Pittsburgh to have the sense that what we do here is part of a global action. It's actually happening all over the world. So some other time, maybe Kate will arrange and we can have a discussion on that. I will mention two other points which kind of relate to the South African issue. As it was at the request of Palestinians that I was invited to speak at the UN. And when I spoke at the UN, I spoke at the invitation of a particular section which is called the Division of the United Nations on Palestinian Affairs. And I was asked to address that section on developing a strategy in support of the Palestinians similar to the strategy I had helped to develop in taking on the apartheid system and dismantling the apartheid system. So there is at the moment a very serious attempt to develop a global approach on the lines of the global approach that we had in opposing apartheid on the question of the occupation of Palestinians, Palestine, and arriving at a just social solution in that area. So we will be part of that. And I got Porto Alegre, I met with South Africans like Salim Valley and others who are part of the Palestinian Solidarity Committee in South Africa, which was in Beirut for a conference organizing again in support of the Palestinians. So I throw all these facts at you, and we don't really have time to deal with them in any depth, but just in an effort to give you a sense that this is an issue on which people all over the world are not only expressing concern, but are beginning to mobilize, are beginning to organize. One of the things they've started in South Africa is a protest against Caterpillar. They call Caterpillar the crusher of homes. And they are beginning to organize against Caterpillar, which is, of course, as you know, one of the major producers of bulldozers and backhoes and all kinds of equipment, destructive equipment. All of this comes together. And finally, I'm going to say that in my own tentative approach, in my own efforts to be helpful, including when I spoke at the UN, when I was asked questions about what are the solutions that are currently being attempted, and supposing those solutions don't work, what then? And I said that it seemed to me that some of the current efforts at a solution are based essentially on a kind of division, not unlike the one we had in South Africa, where a white minority attempted to create what were called Bantustans, with a kind of phony independence, so that you were a pseudo-sovereign state, but you had no real sovereignty, no real independence. And so I said at the UN, and I said it rather nervously, because I know there are people who don't agree with me on this, I said, in time, the solution in the Middle East for both the people of Palestine and the people of Israel may be a single, secular, democratic state in which all religions would be treated with respect, all religions would be given equal status in terms of their own religious beliefs, but politically, the solution is to arrive at a single, secular, non-theocratic state. That's the solution I offer with respect, because, of course, it is the people of Palestine, the people of Israel, who must decide for themselves what the solution is that they're going to arrive at. But whatever that solution is, we who are interested in social justice, interested in freedom, and are troubled about the way the United States is guilty and is complicit in supporting the oppression of the people of Palestine, it is for us to make a stand and to support those who are struggling for the freedom, the liberation of the people of Palestine. So thank you.